if you look at the AI models that you can host sovereignly in Europe, this is much cheaper than accessing a GPT 5.5 or a Fable those proprietary state-of-the-art models. They are so expensive now. And we see this pattern now that a lot of companies are interested in reducing their costs and at the same time increasing their independence. So this is kind of a sweet spot.
Hello and welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. I'm Carsten Bange, founder and CEO of Bark, and my guest today is Maya Himmer, and she is AI and Sovereignty Strategy Lead at T-Systems, so one of the providers of sovereign infrastructure in Europe. I wanted to hear from her, first of all, her take on the sovereignty discussion. So is it really that companies are now starting to invest in it, or are they still only talking about it? And then I discuss with her, how is sovereignty actually being implemented in terms of what is actually being offered as, for example, infrastructure or platforms as a service today, and where all this is leading, with a special focus on AI. So we are looking at AI models and where to run them, and that in this specific case, the cost considerations and big headaches of many companies is very well aligned with the sovereignty considerations they have, because especially in the AI field, cost is now one of the major drivers of change. And we discuss what she sees there and what companies are actually doing. We end with some practical questions to ask if you want to address sovereignty better and how you can approach that. Interesting episode. Enjoy it. Hi, Maya. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. Maya, our topic is obviously data sovereignty and everything that is basically related to this topic, because you are one of the big experts in this topic. Let me start with a general question. What's your perception? Did the latest news, like the Fable, let's call it incident, so the pulling back of this model, what did that do to the whole discussion from your point of view?
It did a lot. So the whole topic of sovereignty, we're now talking to companies that considered themselves global companies and not affected by this whole sovereignty discussion, and now they're suddenly interested. So Fable, also the GitHub Copilot priced model change was a huge trigger. I mean, we just see how tokens are being consumed, and token consumption is going up exponentially for companies, large companies. They now consider tokenomics a key topic. So this whole topic, like, where can I get access to the best model, and what does it cost me, and how reliable is it, and so on. So it's a very strong discussion topic now everywhere. And it's, as you said, highly related to the sovereignty topic.
Absolutely. I can confirm that. We had so many discussions at the Data Festival recently that the two topics are really tightly, let's say, bundled in a way, because cost often drives very similar discussions in terms of what do I need now? What do I use, actually? I think driven very much by AI, because that's where the new experiences are to be made. You also mentioned it, tokens for general AI or gen AI systems are the big topics, but sovereignty is related to that. So what's then your overall point of view here? So you mentioned there had been a change, but how did that change? In a way, how strategic is sovereignty now for organizations or for companies?
I think you can decide between different clusters of companies, right? There are the ones in the highly regulated industries, health, public sector, also finance. They have been considering sovereignty as an important core concept in their businesses anyhow for years already. And then there are the ones that maybe produce intellectual property or are handling some kind of sensitive data, but they aren't really object to strong regulations, so they can kind of define their own desired level of sovereignty. I mean, within the, let's say, GDPR compliance. And there it is, I think, where we see, where we have already seen a bit of change in the past years. So where sovereignty is more about resilience for the businesses that are, for example, in production, and that are heavily reliant on non-European services. I mean, in Europe, yeah, there was this Draghi study which said that 80% of the digital services in Europe that we consume come from non-European vendors and providers. So this was a very strong finding already a few years ago. Not so much has changed. And now in those industries, I would say, yes, sovereignty is now more about resilience and about independence, about having the freedom of choice in case there are any incidents. And then I think there is this third cluster of companies, which also was not really affected by this discussion about this operational resilience, but that now looks at the AI model space, about the recent incidents that you mentioned earlier, where suddenly the newest technologies are not coming to Europe anymore. And I mean, Fable was not the first one. I think Meta did the beginning a few years, or maybe one and a half years back, with the newest Llama models that they didn't ship to Europe anymore because of the EU AI Act and like a big hurdle on regulatory issues they had. So this is not really new, but the better those models are becoming and the more we build our core businesses and our daily operational work around it, the more we are reliant and not reliant, dependent on those non-European AI model providers, of course, cloud providers as well. So yeah, I think that's the evolution of how sovereignty has been seeing increasing interest.
Absolutely. If I look at our recent study, our survey on that, one of the findings was that more or less everyone thinks it's super important. So it's either even of rising importance. But then if we asked, or when we asked, but what do you actually do about it? And do you invest? Do you have budget for sovereignty initiatives and so on? Then obviously the enthusiasm was not as high. So I think there's a difference between finding a topic super important and then actually doing something about it. Question to you is, do you see a change? So did all these latest developments actually now lead to that decision makers now actually act?
Yes, it's a good question. It's a very sensitive topic, because as you mentioned, I think most leaders ship that topic back to their IT departments. They say, sovereignty, security, that's all one thing. You handle that, And on the other hand, the IT departments, they are on pressure to save costs and not to spend more money on like more sovereign solutions. And there's no real, this one point in a company where sovereignty is a strategic topic with a budget. So Systems, actually, I think the first company that assigned the role of the chief sovereignty officer. So I think Fortis Systems is also not new to talk about the sovereign topic. We did that for many years. So for us, it's kind of natural to have someone who is dedicated in pushing that topic further. But yeah, so this is definitely similar to this chief data officer role, which had kind of also not one department, but the whole organization to work with him or her on bringing a data strategy in place in the company. I think it's very similar with sovereignty, because you don't look at sovereignty from a single point of view. It's not only about cloud or only about where your data sits or only about models. It touches everything. And yeah, I think your question was about whether we actually see companies act upon it now. Slowly, yes.
Okay, but a yes. So there is change to the better in a way, or to the topic. But I think that's good to hear. That's really good. You see patterns how companies approach the topic. So are there certain things that they like address first, or what's of biggest importance to them?
So when we split it into the, let's say, cloud discussion and the AI discussion a bit. Then certainly in the cloud area, this is where when you talk about having your data stored and with a European provider or processed in a European sovereign cloud, this usually comes at a higher price. Not always, maybe, but in many cases, obviously the hyperscalers have other kinds of economics because they're, I don't know how many orders of magnitude larger. So it's maybe even easier now to start with the AI side, because if you look at the AI models that you can host sovereignly in Europe, these open models, this is much cheaper than accessing a GPT 5.5 or a Fable those proprietary state-of-the-art models. They are so expensive now. When you look at the token costs, that it's easier, and we see this pattern now, that a lot of companies are interested in reducing their costs and at the same time increasing their independence. So this is kind of a sweet spot right now.
Yeah, I can completely agree. I see the same. That especially cost pressure that we have here in many European companies, especially in Central Europe, is driving them to that topic. A multi-cloud approach seems to be a pretty common way to tackle sovereignty in companies. Do you see the same?
Absolutely. It's one relatively straightforward way to get less dependent, right? So take Deutsche Telekom as an example. Of course, we have a huge part of our applications running on the hyperscalers, I think 60% or so. Mm-hmm. And we also have 10% of the stuff still running on legacy on-premise systems. And maybe that's like never going to be fully cloudified. But we, of course, also use our own sovereign infrastructure. I think about 30% now we have on T-Cloud public or like T-Cloud related infrastructure, our own dedicated infrastructure, whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we always push to increase that because, of course, it makes a lot of sense to utilize what you have also for your own and for cloud, but of course also for AI, as we discussed.
And how much on-prem? So you have public cloud or hyperscale?
Yeah, 10% about, I think I said. So 10% we say we still have on-premise. And I think that's mainly also legacy systems that are not so easy to move to cloud.
Okay. So 10% on-prem, 30% in your sovereign own infrastructure, and 60% in the hyperscalers?
That's about the distribution.
That's interesting. Let's dive a little bit deeper into, because on the one side, you as T-Systems, you have an offering. Yeah? On the other hand, you have a big corporation going with Google, so one of the hyperscalers. So how's that working? So how do you do that? Doing both at the same time.
I mean, we have corporations and, or let's say, partnerships with all of the hyperscalers because we're traditionally an IT systems integrator, a consultancy company. So we, of course, also offer managed cloud services for all the US-based hyperscalers. That's what customers demand, and we are the service providers for that. And then when you mention Google, I think what you're referring to is this Google Sovereign Cloud. Systems has been trying to bring into the market, what, like 2 years ago. It still exists, but it didn't really work the way it was supposed to be working, I would say. So I don't think we have a lot of customers interested in that. And I mean, I understand it. It was not having the same level of functionality as the normal Google Cloud. And yeah. We now moved our strategy entirely to having our own cloud infrastructure. So, I mean, we already have the T-Cloud public for a long time. It was usually, in the past, it was called Open Telecom Cloud. It's over 10 years, I think now, maybe even 15 years old. I don't know the exact number. And it makes absolute sense to promote this as the sovereign cloud offering more than a US-based hyperscaler sovereign cloud. Yeah. So that's why I wouldn't like put any emphasis on this Google thing. When we talk about sovereign cloud, we talk about T-Cloud public, our private cloud offerings, and now recently also about the industrial AI cloud. So AI compute, AI factory that we built in Munich and that we're operating now.
Interesting. Okay. And what's your ambition there? with T-Cloud. So do you want to become like a German, a European hyperscaler? Where does that lead? Or what's the strategy behind it?
I mean, we kind of already are. When you look at the recent like analyst ratings and so on, we are already the number one European hyperscaler alternative. Although you wouldn't probably classify it as a hyperscaler, but more like a superscaler, maybe, yeah, because it's, as I said, it's a bit smaller. But from the European sovereign cloud landscape, it's the most mature public cloud solution. And when you compare it with hyperscaler functionality, you see 80% feature parity in the core features. And on the agenda, we have to increase that to 100% of the core features until the end of this year. So yeah, most of the features that people are going to use, you know, maybe not the super special serverless non-SQL database, but I mean, this was an example. I don't even know if we have this, to be honest. But but the things that are used the most, we will have, and or we are already having. So I wouldn't say that this is only the strategy, but and not a new strategy. Of course, it's the strategy to position this as a leading public cloud in Europe. And it has, I mean, it's in Germany for sure, but we also have data centers in Switzerland and Netherlands. So it's certainly a European offering, not just for the German market.
Okay, very good. And you talked about core services. I'd like to know more about that from a specific viewpoint of data and AI. So obviously there's infrastructure as a service, but then if we move, I'm thinking about these, let's say, pretty old layers in terms of service, but above that is platform as a service, which I think still works because you need databases, you need data integration, technology, and similar. So what are you offering there?
I cannot tell you in 20 minutes because there are hundreds of services that we offer, and different types of databases are certainly part of that. Container registries, the typical things like virtualization layers, even like data pipelining frameworks, like it's called, I think it's Data Arts, or like things that are similar to the AWS SageMaker, a model building platform. It's called Model Arts. So there is a huge package of services. You can check out on the website. I think there's also an overview what you can book, how it's called. And I think we even have tables that compare these services to the equivalents of the hyperscaler. So for anyone interested in moving, it's kind of easy to define a map, a migration map. How's that service called in our world? And I mean, we also offer migration services to help that transition, of course, Sam. And I think what's special with us is this industrial AI cloud, which is really not just we have put a number of GPUs into our existing data centers, but we built a real AI factory based on reference gold standard architecture, as NVIDIA suggests, to connect these GPUs together, such that you can really bring the most performance out of the GPUs. We put the two GPU types that are together in the combination, covering a wide variety of different workload types. And this is really our, let's say, AI engine that you can use for heavy AI workloads.
Okay. And how do companies get access to that? What's your motto there?
I mean, if you want to go into that specifics, so this would be a dedicated access point that we set up. So it's not like reachable via the public internet, but you would have a dedicated IPsec tunnel.
Okay. Since we are already now touching on AI and AI workloads, let's dive a little bit deeper into that. What's your take on sovereignty and AI models? So what are companies now concerned about? What are they doing?
Yeah, I think the discussion, no, we already have it, that you think cloud, and then maybe you think data, and then now you use that data to train models and to ingest it into models so that you can run models, and then you build applications, workflows, agentic systems. And along this whole stack, you would want to consider sovereignty. And with AI, you also have those different layers. Yeah, you have the AI models, And maybe let me start with a definition of how we classify this in terms of sovereignty. So you have the proprietary models that are not sovereign at all, because they're like a black box. You get an API, you send something, you get something back. There's no sovereignty involved. Then you have the data sovereignty level, where you say, I have control over my data. I know where my data sits. I know where my data is going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so at least you have a feeling you have some control over your data. And this is where in the AI model layer, I would say the open weight models live. So you have the weights, those parameters that you can download. You need the architecture of a model, and then you can deploy a model on your own hardware. So that means you have, if you do that on, let's say, the hyperscalers, it still goes to the hyperscalers, but you have control over the model. You can host it yourself.
Uh-huh.
And then if we go into the next level of sovereignty, that would be operational sovereignty. So in a cloud perspective, this would be the case where you say, I know I have myself the kill switch. Nobody can switch off my services because I operate the cloud. And for the AI model, I mean, this maybe not exactly mappable to these sovereignty mm-hmm. levels. So because open weight could also be considered as operational sovereignty. But the next level when we consider models would be open source models. So there you don't only have access to the weights and the architecture and can run the model, but you can actually look at the source code. How was the model trained? And that gives you more transparency into whether the model is aligned with your values. For example, if you have insight into the training data, you could see if there are any data biases within the training data set that, for example, you train image recognition model. Yeah, so to take a very simple example, and it has only been trained on white people. So it will never recognize a black person as a person, but maybe as some form of animal or so. Yeah, so this has happened in the past, like 10 years ago or so. So it's a very easy to understand example of how bias works. And of course, it's a good way to make sure that the model you're using is or can be compliant with your local regulations or with your values and so on. And then there are various levels. Yeah, some providers give you the training code, but not the data. Some give you insight into how they chose the training data, but this whole like training cycle is not really published. So it's sometimes a bit, there are like gray areas. You cannot really draw strict lines. Then there are certain licenses also, like some are published under a commercially available license, some are under a restricted license. So lots of things to be considered. But what we consider as the highest level of sovereignty, so the technological sovereignty, where you really have control over the technology. And I mean, when you think of hardware, this is really difficult in Europe because we don't really have GPUs. And I honestly don't believe that this is going to change, that we have like really high performance GPUs in the next few years. But if you look at models, there are some initiatives to build models in Germany, in Europe, that are then fully compliant with the EU AI Act, that are fully transparent, and also cover all European languages, for example, that make sure that this model is, aligned with our European values. And so the most recent example for that is, for example, SOFI. So from the German AI Association, like lots of different research institutes and universities that came together to say, let us train a large language model in Germany from scratch that fulfills all these criteria. So basically we, not maybe we as a person or we as a company, but we as a state or as a political region can say we have technological sovereignty over this model. The SOFI model is actually being trained on our industrial AI cloud. So we're very proud that we already Ori can serve such a nice sovereign AI initiative with this data center that we built.
Interesting. So there are lots of interesting things in there. Just, I found it interesting that you are differentiating between open weight and open source models, because often they're used synonymously. So maybe could you give us a few examples so that it gets a bit clearer what you mean? I mean, when you refer to proprietary models, obviously you're talking about ChatGPT or on the Anthropic models and so on. What do you refer to, or what do you see maybe the most popular or most often used open weight and open source models?
So to be fair, most open models that we see today are open weight models. Open source models are very rare. Mm-hmm. There have been some in the past, Bloom and so on, but they haven't really made it into this area of large language models that we're talking about today. Actually, not sure. I think there are some. So sometimes DeepSeek, I believe, is considered open source because there was this one model type where they have published it in an open source kind of fashion. But yeah, as I said, so sometimes it's a bit of a gray area. So when do you actually consider it open source? Or how much of their training pipeline do they have to publish that you say, okay, this is really open source? But so this open source that goes into the European open source area, I think that's where we have the most popular options. So these Sophie models, and there are also a few others like Apertus from Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Or the previous generation of Sophie that was called Toykin, but it was a rather small model. So those, I believe, are proper open source models.
Interesting. So again, experience from our client interactions, I was surprised that there seemed to be quite a big openness towards Chinese models like Qwen, or you mentioned already DeepSeek. So it sounded to me that for many companies, it's not a big issue to use them if they now do the step that you also mentioned, that they start to look into alternatives, often trying to run now models on-prem, especially to avoid token costs. So it's really often more a cost issue, and something mm-hmm. comes as a benefit, as we already discussed. So what's your take? Do you also see that, that there's an openness towards Chinese models, or maybe you see it differently?
No, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the most recent evolvements in the open model space, you see how the gap is really closing to the proprietary ones. There was GLM 5.1 released, and 2 weeks later, GLM 5.2. So Chinese open weight models, but that are so powerful that they play on the same level like Gemini, Flash, the most recent Gemini models, or also GPT models, or Claude Opus 4.8. Those models. So there's really this, you can look at the website artificialanalysis.ai. That's a project where they aggregate different evaluation metrics, so like 9 different evaluation metrics, and combine that into one single number. And there Claude Fable, for example, has this index 60, GLM 5.2 has 51, and I don't know, GPT 5.5 has maybe 55 or so. So the gap is really closing really quickly. And some people believe that next year there will literally be no difference anymore between what open and what proprietary models can achieve. I don't know. I think we will only know next year. But what we will definitely have is that open models next year will be much more powerful than proprietary models this year.
Yeah, which leads us, I think, to an important topic, that is that companies need to basically classify and make up their mind level of sovereignty they actually need. I mean, for these models, we see it. If that is true, what you just said, or if that really comes will be the case next year, then I think the business models of OpenAI and Anthropic are in pretty big trouble. But let's see.
That's why they push so hard on vendor lock-in this year. They give you like free tokens for 7 weeks now with Fable. or in the beginning, the prices with ChatGPT were so incredibly low that they must have lost a lot of money just to give people that, you know, that kind of that iPhone moment. Ah, AI? Okay, AI is equal to ChatGPT. So this was, I think, strategic to now be able to raise the prices.
Yeah, so basically people or companies have to understand, yeah, what level do they need, yeah, what performance, and then they can decide also which, for example, which model they should use.
I think it's, when we talk about sovereignty, yeah, you have these different levels, but also not every workload that you have or every use case needs the same level of sovereignty. And therefore, it's good to also have a choice. So you can use, for example, for non-sensitive coding, you can use the proprietary ones and still fall back to open models for more sensitive workloads. For example, what we have into systems, we call it AI Foundation Services. It's exactly that kind of an API gateway that gives you access to models, no matter whether they are proprietary and hosted on the hyperscalers or sovereign models, open models that are hosted sovereignly on to systems infrastructure. I think having such kind of access point to easily switch models depending on what becomes available newly and what fits your needs. This is and with that we are already in the question of how to implement sovereignty in everyday life, I think.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what I was leading to with, yeah. So how do we do that now in practical life? So maybe let me ask you a simple question. What questions should companies ask themselves? What do they need to ask?
Yeah, you can ask a lot of questions. And I think an easy way to get started is thinking about the, in Germany, I always say the five W's, but in English, one is the how. So it's where, who, how, what, and when. And along those five question words, you can phrase questions across all levels of your technological stack. So for cloud, for example, who operates my cloud infrastructure? For data, you can ask, where is my data located? Or for the AI level, you can ask, what has been the purpose for which the model that was trained, or what is the defined architecture behind that model? Or how would a certain use case change the behavior of the model? And if you go to the applications level, so basically the use cases, you can ask, when should I expect that something changes in, for example, the pricing model of the application, or in having access to certain types of technology? So I think those five questions just help thinking about the different levels in such a deep way that you have an initial assessment where you stand. And then you can always say, okay, so I don't have full control, but that's fine for me because of reasons.
No, I think that's a useful advice. Yeah, that's a good starting point to get everything structured and sorted. And
if you need a more, let's say, professional assessment, the systems has, of course, also assessments ready for that. So hyperscaler risk assessment goes into that direction where we assess the cloud landscape of a company and how the hyperscalers are distributed across the various departments.
Our time is already up, but let me end this conversation with the latest and greatest, which are obviously AI agents. So what's your take? How does building AI agents now change the sovereignty discussion?
When you have an agent, you have, of course, models behind that. So I could say one model, one agent, but in multi-agent landscapes, you typically have also different models for different tasks. But the model is not everything. You need a memory, you need data sources connected to your agent, to your model. You need tools, and all of that builds the agent harness. That's how we call it. Yeah. So there's the model and there's the harness. And for every single thing that you connect the model to, you need also to assess how is that sovereign? How does it need to be sovereign? And agents are giving really models and agents autonomy to do things on their own is super risky. And a lot of companies, including us, are now building enterprise platforms for that. So including governance into this. So for example, look at different agentic platforms. There's these proprietary agent frameworks that help, that are closely tied to, for example, a proprietary AI model and that work very well with it. But once you want to move away from that model, you have to also move to another agent framework because it doesn't support swapping out models. So just by defining your initial agent stack, you already define how easy or difficult it will be later on for you to switch vendors. And the same is true for the protocols that are being used for the agents to communicate. There are more proprietary frameworks like, in, I think it's called Agentic Commerce Protocol, which is also from one of the US hyperscalers. And then there are more open protocols like, the most famous being MCP for sure. And I think having, the awareness about all these different things that are tied together to bring agents to life, not only the model and not only where they are running, helps to, from the start, define the correct architecture. And of course, by accident, T-Systems also builds an agentic AI hub right now to do exactly that in an open ecosystem and vendor agnostic fashion.
Mm-hmm. I would call that sovereignty by design.
Yeah, exactly.
And you build up your strategy and the architecture, how you want to build agents, then you should really think about sovereignty from the ground up, from the very beginning. And then you would save a lot of headaches and problems later.
I mean, it's also what people do in software engineering. Yeah? So back in the days, you built monolithic applications. Nowadays, you build modular, microservice-based software. So to do exactly that, to be able to swap out features and functionalities.
Yeah. So we basically should reuse what we have learned also apply it here. Maya, that's a great conversation. Thanks so much for sharing your insights.
Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. And all I can say, hope to see you soon again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.